Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $150 into something bigger when you bet on moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$150 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
You know how in football, timing is everything? You miss your window by a second and the play's already gone. The holidays are the same way. Everything happens fast, and if you're not ready, you're scrambling at the last minute. That's why Amazon Prime is the real MVP this season.
With Prime's fast, free shipping, you can make those last-minute calls look effortless. Forgot your secret Santa gift? Need something for that office party? Prime's got your back, helping you go from uh-oh to all set faster than a two-minute drill.
Absolutely, Mark, because Prime isn't just about getting things fast. It's about making sure you never miss your shot. It turns that last-minute scramble into a smooth holiday win. So this season, remember, Prime's fast delivery has your back during the holidays, especially when it's down to the wire and can't wait another minute. Last-minute gifts delivered. It's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to shop now.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
So you want to start a business? You might think you need a team of people and fancy tech skills, but you don't. You just need GoDaddy Aero. I'm Walton Goggins, and as an actor, I'm an expert in looking like I know what I'm doing. GoDaddy Aero uses AI to create everything you need to grow a business. It'll make you a unique logo. It'll create a custom website. It'll write social posts for you and even set you up with a social media calendar. Get started at GoDaddy.com/Aero. That's GoDaddy.com/AIRO.
Philly, you are so wonderful and interesting. You deserve a local news podcast all your own.
Check out the JohnCast on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
KYW News Radio Original Podcasts.
It's just a good conversation with somebody that you didn't know you were interested in. I'm Matt Leon, and this is One on One.
27 years later, I definitely made the best decision ever. Coaching the women at Gwinnett for the basically almost three decades has been probably one of the greatest experiences that I had professionally in my career. So, you know, at that part, back in 1995, I had no idea that I'd be sitting here talking to you right now.
And our guest this week is Keith Mondillo, the AD and women's basketball coach at Division III Gwinnett Mercy University. Keith, thanks so much for taking the time.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Matt. I look forward to it.
As we're talking here, you're in the heart of the season. How much fun has it been to just kind of be back into a full, relatively close to normal grind of a college basketball season?
Yeah, you wouldn't think you would miss it as much as you did until you went through last year. You know, everybody gets up and down on their teams as the season goes along, but we didn't have that last year. And we had a handful of practices and two games. We had a senior night, and then we had a senior night for the team that we played. So getting back to this, and especially with our players, luckily all of them being fully vaccinated, it's made it a lot easier. That doesn't mean we've had some of our student athletes get sick, but yeah, this year, Matt, it's been a tremendous year since 2019-20 seems like an eternity ago. And, you know, we talked about our men's coach, John Barron. He played in the ECAC tournament, and the day after that tournament was over, everything shut down, and no one knew it was going to be as long as it was. So, yes, I am very grateful for the season.
In a way, did the, you know, if we're looking for a silver lining, did the year away, and you talk about being grateful, does it recharge in a way that you kind of get that excitement to get back out there and you kind of remember the little things that you maybe start to take for granted, and once they're taken away, you get a new look at it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's really the interaction with the students that you miss, you know, developing a team, coming over a hurdle, trying to figure out how to get by that hurdle, and just constantly developing throughout the year. So yeah, this season, especially in October when we started practice, it was like starting all over again. You know, we had a bunch of freshmen last year that really didn't get any on-court instruction. So we essentially have two freshman classes. So, and this year we have no seniors. So our four juniors are our leadership. And then we're kind of teaching our sophomores and freshmen almost as one class right now. So yeah, this year was a total rejuvenation of my batteries in order to, you know, to coach for this year. And I'm, you know, we're almost through February and our conference playoffs start in 2 weeks. And you almost wish it doesn't end, you know, keep going, keep playing in the March. That's our goal is and our hope is.
I want you to take the basketball coach hat off, put the athletic director hat on. How challenging has the AD role been the last year or so from a day-to-day and a big picture standpoint?
I don't think people realize how difficult it was. You know, we're trying to get our student athletes engaged and trying to get them back onto the playing field. And myself, our head athletic trainer and our leadership here at the university, just like every other university, we're formulating plans for return to play in accordance with the NCAA guidelines. And every time you get to that point, those guidelines would change or something would change. I think we put together about three return to play reports before we actually got to implement one of them. And we didn't have a traditional fall or winter season last year. We did get on the field for those student athletes. And we had a relatively normal spring season with an occasional pause here and there. The challenge last year was being able to pivot at the drop of a dime and staying positive and just trying to see the bigger picture in things. And I think we did a good job. I think all of our institutions in this region, especially here at Gwinnett, we kept our student athletes safe. We followed all the protocols and we gave our student athletes the best experience we could under the circumstances. So it was very challenging, Matt.
When did you get the AD role as well?
Well, this is my 27th year as the women's coach. I believe it was in my third year.
Okay. So
fourth year. So about 23, 24 years. I should know that, right?
How long did it take to be able to kind of silo off the two jobs? And obviously they work, you know, being a coach and athletic, but I've had friends that do both at various levels. And I'm always amazed when you go into their office, you know, 20 minutes before a game and they're on the phone and you think, oh, they're talking to a recruit or somebody. No, they're talking to the laundry room because the uniforms for baseball didn't go from A to B like they were supposed to. And it's just always amazing how you can kind of shut that off and then focus on the game. How long did it take you to be able to kind of juggle everything and still give the coaching role the attention it needs?
Well, that's still a process. It's always a process. And I had some pretty good mentors along the way that have, you know, taught me how to organize my day and how to organize each role and how it relates, especially when you're in season. So I think it's a constant evolution. I don't think there was a time that I said, all right, this is how it's going to be. I mean, I'm walking from my locker room to the gym on game day, and there's 8-9 minutes on the clock before it starts. And I'll have a coach or a student athlete grab me and ask me a question. And just to take 30 seconds out of the day to answer whatever question, if I didn't have the answer then, you know, to say, hey, call me tomorrow and we'll be able to sit down and go over it further. I don't think that'll ever end, being in the AD, just because, you know, you're trying to serve several constituents on your campus, from student athletes to coaches to administrators to people above you. So it's a constant juggling act that, you know, I like to think I do a good job doing that. I could probably get better at it, but it's difficult at times. You know, like you said, like I'm, you know, in after a game, after a tough loss, you go back to your office and maybe someone needs to talk to you about something going on with the men's game. So you really have to shut things down as the coach, and then you have to put on your AD hat.
So let's talk a little bit about your origin story with basketball. Were you always a basketball junkie as a kid, or did you play whatever was going on in the neighborhood or whatever was in season?
Yeah, I grew up in the Roxborough, Manayunk area of Philadelphia. So it was seasonal. You know, football in the fall, basketball in the winter, baseball in the spring and summer. And it really wasn't until late grade school, probably early high school, where I caught the basketball bug. Played both growing up. But, you know, I was lucky enough to live in Roxborough, where we had, you know, Speedy Morris lived around the corner from. And seeing what he did and how he went about his life and the professionalism that he exuded, it just drew you. I mean, I think young in my career as a basketball player, I knew I wanted to coach. I just didn't know where or when or how. So it wasn't until really high school where I concentrated on basketball. And, you know, it just turned into a career. I didn't even really think I was going to have a career out of it. But 27 years later as a head coach and probably 30 years as a overall coach in college, yeah, I'm just lucky to where I'm at right now.
You went to Archbishop Kennedy, correct?
Archbishop Kennedy and Conshohocken.
What were some of your favorite memories from your playing days there?
I think it's just the guys that you're with, you know, in the locker room. I still talk to several of them today. I'm still friends with a guy, Gene Sweater, I grew up with around the corner in Roxburgh, and we played in high school together, and we talk all the time today. I think some of our favorite memories, I played with a young man who was All-State named Chris Kaufman. We got to play in some pretty big games. And just the town of Conshohocken itself, even growing up in Philadelphia, I love Philadelphia, but Conshohocken was such a close-knit community, and they cared so much about their sons and daughters and how they played and where they played. And then it was just a supportive atmosphere. And Kennedy was one of the greatest high schools ever. You know, it's a shame that, you know, it had emerged and eventually closed down. But what an experience, you know, growing up. We were pretty successful. We won the districts my junior year, went pretty far in states, and we were very competitive my senior year. So my memories are, I mean, it transcends basketball. It's just everything about, you know, the high school. We had a football coach named Chris Bockrath, who was one of the most successful high school coaches in the area. And, you know, talk about a mentor in high school. He was a mentor to everybody. You know, everybody felt they were close to him, and he was close to everybody. He was just a good guy. So high school memories are tremendous. You know, if I could go back and do it again, I would do it all over again.
After high school, you went to Arcadia to hoop. Was that, were there other schools you were looking at, or were they always the one that showed the most interest?
Well, I went to Eastern University my freshman year.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, to be quite honest with you, I was the sixth guard on a 5-guard rotation team as a freshman. So I didn't see much future in me playing there. It was a great school. And I still talk to guys who I played with there. And then, long story short, ran into a friend of mine, a guy named Gene Camp, who went to play at North Catholic. And I saw him over that summer, and he said, yeah, why don't think about transferring to Arcadia and play here. And at the drop of a dime, I applied, was accepted, and next thing I was at Arcadia. And that was another great experience. Talk about, you know, having, you know, friends on the team and as you're playing, but then they're friends to me today. Like, they're at my kids' parties, I'm at their children's parties, or each other's weddings. Arcadia was a great place. They were growing at the time. We had a coach named Mike Holland, who was probably the perfect person for that job at the time. He was building a program at a school that had no reputation athletically, and did a great job of creating a family atmosphere. He was actually Jay Wright's high school coach at Council Rock. So there's that unique, you know, bloodline between Arcadia basketball and Jay Wright. It was a great experience. I, you know, wound up playing there for my last 3 years, started for 2 years, and just had a fun time and a great career.
Scout your game for me.
When I went in, I was a typical suburban jump shooter. And then when I went to Eastern, my roommate was a kid who went to Simon Gratz, a kid named Bo Thompson, and he taught me how to play. So I think when I got to Arcadia, I think I was an all-around better player. I wasn't a point guard. I wasn't a shooting guard. I was just a guard. So I did a lot of things well, I didn't do anything extravagant, like anything that was really good. I didn't hit like 93s in a game or something like that. But I was your typical tough Philly guard.
You mentioned earlier that you knew you wanted to coach, didn't know what that would look like. As your college career is winding down, are you starting to position yourself and seeing what it looks like and how you get in the door somewhere?
Matt, the complete opposite. I wanted to be an attorney. And I knew I wanted to coach, but I'm thinking coaching like high school, you know, helping out as an assistant. So my first job a week out of college, I worked for the Third Circuit Court of Appeals down Sixth and Market. And I was down there and I thought, like, this is the perfect opportunity for me to become an attorney. Then I realized what attorneys actually did. And I'm like, I'm not going to do that stuff. That, I mean, I saw the judges' law clerks come in and they're bleary eyed and, you know, it looked like they had no sleep. And I'm like, this is not a life for me. And then ironically, I was playing in a summer league at the Orland Playground, which is a very competitive summer league. And then I ran into the gentleman who was the men's basketball coach at Gwinnett Mercy at the time. His name was Keith Rice. He said, would you be interested in helping out this year? Never even thought about it. I said, sure, I'll help out. You know, it's close, you know, to my house. It's only about 20 minutes. And that's how I started. You know, I was working for the federal government. And by chance, I ran into a gentleman, you know, who was a coach at Gwinnett Mercy. And I helped him out for years as assistant coach. And that's how I started coaching.
Was it apparent to you that that was the fit, like that you were going, this was going to be more than just something you did twice a week, you know, to help out?
Yeah, absolutely. Once you got involved in it and you saw, you know, how influential you could be to a student or a team in, overall. Yeah, Matt, 100%. It was like, you know, it was catching a fever of coaching. Like you caught the coaching bug. And that's what started going out recruiting. I think I talked to more recruits we didn't get today than ever before, just because you develop those relationships. And most college coaches despise recruiting. That was the thing that I loved to do. So, yeah, at that point, I started to think, how can I do this full time?
Why did you love the recruiting so much? Was it just meeting the people and convincing them to come your way?
I think it was a little bit of a few things. That being it, you know, the game within a game, like trying to beat out another school for a kid that you really wanted. But it is about building relationships. When I have a recruit on campus and I walk, you know, a student athlete around with their parents, like that's my job for that day, is to talk to that student about Gwinnett Mercy. And how great is that? You know, that you're actually, and we've gotten more no's than yeses over the years. And it's just the relationships that you develop that, you know, some students that have decided to go to other universities, other schools over my career, I still talk to. You know, sometimes I'm their references for their first job application, just because we've always kept in touch. So I think recruiting is, as long as you're organized and you stay on top of things and you have really good assistant coaches that do follow-ups, that I think it's really not that hard of a job.
From, you know, the thing that I've always been curious about recruiting, or interested, I should say, how did you feel comfortable evaluating the talent right away? Like, did you trust yourself that you had a good judge of who could really play and who could do what the system you're recruiting for would plug in? Or was that something that took a few cycles of maybe trial and error before you really got a feel for who fits where?
Yeah, I think it's the latter. It was trial and error. I would go to recruiting events and I would say, hey, I think that girl can really help us in 2 years. And a friend of mine who's coaching like a Division I school. So that's great, Keith, but she's already been scholarshiped at 5 Division I schools I've offered already. So it took me a while on the girls' high school basketball side to figure out, you know, who fit and what level. You recruit boys out of Philadelphia Catholic League or Philadelphia Public League. There's kids in the Philadelphia Public League that are honorable mention that are getting scholarships, you know, the Division I. So that didn't happen a lot in on the girls' side. So it took a few cycles to try and figure out you know, who fit and who didn't fit. And I was lucky enough that, you know, I had a good friend in coaching and, you know, just growing up, Ryan Morris, actually Speedy Morris' son, who helped me get in on some of these Catholic League kids that we got early on in my career. And, you know, it kind of jump-started our program from glorified intramurals to a team that was competitive within the region.
How much of an advantage, because you talked about a lot of coaches don't like recruiting, how much of an advantage do you feel it gives when it is something that you genuinely relish, that maybe that you go to that extra showcase or you make that extra phone call that maybe another coach who's just tired of it, you know, wants to get through it, knows it's a necessary evil. I would imagine maybe that helps get you to the finish line. Not all the time, but here and there that it doesn't for other coaches.
Well, I think early on it helped. Early on in my career, because I think you could outwork coaches, but as you and I spoke prior to jumping on this call, technology has kind of leveled that playing field. So you can send out an email or a text message to 50 recruits with just one click of a button. So I don't think there's much advantage now because everyone's kind of doing the same thing. You know, we're always constantly following up, whether it's a phone call or text message or email. So I think early on when the technology wasn't there and you had to go to high school games, now everything's done in the summer. You know, you go to high school games as a follow-up almost to the kids you got up on campus in August and September. So, yeah, I mean, I do think it's a necessary evil, but it's a necessary evil that I enjoy. And I take it, you know, in our athletic department here, like John Barron, I know you're friends with John. John does a tremendous job recruiting. And when I see him, you know, and our men's lacrosse coach, and they're constantly bringing students up for visits and stuff like that, it kind of motivates you internally to try and top them. So, you know, early on in our career, we used to have contests to see how many kids we can get up in the summer. And not for any reason, just to build our programs. It just helped that we had that little friendly competition internally.
Time for a break on One-on-One. We will have more with Gwinnett Mercy University head women's basketball coach and athletic director Keith Mondillo right after this.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
You open the fridge. There's nothing there. So what's it going to be? Greasy pizza? Sad drive-through burgers? Dish by Blue Apron is for nights like that. These are the pre-made meals of your dreams. At least 20 grams of protein, no artificial flavors or colors, no chopping, no cleanup, no guilt. Keep the flavor. Ditch the subscription. Get 20% off your first two orders with code APRON20. Terms and conditions apply. Visit blueapron.com/terms for more.
You know how in football, timing is everything? You miss your window by a second and the play's already gone. The holidays are the same way. Everything happens fast, and if you're not ready, you're scrambling at the last minute. That's why Amazon Prime is the real MVP this season.
With Prime's fast, free shipping, you can make those last-minute calls look effortless. Forgot your secret Santa gift? Need something for that office party? Prime's got your back, helping you go from uh-oh to all set faster than a two-minute drill.
Absolutely, Mark, because Prime isn't just about getting things fast. It's about making sure you never miss your shot. It turns that last-minute scramble into a smooth holiday win. So this season, remember, Prime's fast delivery has your back during the holidays, especially when it's down to the wire and can't wait another minute. Last-minute gifts delivered. It's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to shop now.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Avoiding your unfinished home projects because you're not sure where to start? Thumbtack knows homes, so you don't have to. Don't know the difference between matte paint finish and satin? Or what that clunking sound from your dryer is? With Thumbtack, you don't have to be a home pro. You just have to hire one. You can hire top-rated pros, see price estimates, and read reviews, all on the app. Download today.
And we are back. Our guest this week is Gwinnett Mercy University head women's basketball coach and athletic director Keith Mondillo. So you get to start at Gwinnett, and then after a season, you go back to your alma mater, Arcadia, for a year. And I'm curious, for that year in Arcadia, I would imagine there are still kids you played with that were on the team. And how difficult was that? I mean, there's a year break and you're not around, so there is kind of that separation where it's not one day your teammates and the next day you're in a position of authority. But did it lead to any awkwardness where, you know, maybe you're in a different role and it just leads to a different dynamic with people you played with?
No, not really, because I mean, I was still young. It was my second year. And yeah, I did play with a bunch of those guys. And I was more of the go-between between our head coach, not that he couldn't do it, but and the players. And our head coach, Mike Holland, gave me a lot of autonomy to do some things. And I would give him suggestions because we were so athletic. I remember that team like it was yesterday, about pressing things and what we can do and how we can trap and rotate. So I think when the players saw that Mike Holland was giving me that latitude, that I wouldn't say it changed over right away, but I think they saw me more as now a coach as opposed to their former teammate. I think we're always going to be former teammates, but what Mike Holland did enabled me to develop as a coach, not only personally, but in the eyes of the players at that time. So it wasn't as awkward or difficult as you would think it would be.
So one season back at your alma mater, and then the women's position at Gwinnett Mercy becomes yours. Kind of what's the road back to Gwinnett and to this, to running your own program?
Well, the gentleman who I coached with, he was an assistant at Arcadia that year, wind up becoming the athletic director at Gwinnett. And at the time, I'm thinking I'm going to be the next Mike Krzyzewski. I know we all laugh about it, but we all, like every coach, young coach, aspires to the highest level. Well, he asked me to coach the women's team at Gwinnett, and I balked for about 2 months. And finally, he said, I'll get it to you. It'll be full time next year. You know, just try it. If you don't like it, you can leave. Well, I had, at that point, I had not coached any sports that involved women. And 27 years later, I definitely made the best decision ever, because I thoroughly enjoy it. Not that I would never go back and coach men. I coach my son's AAU team, but coaching the women at Gwinnett for the basically almost three decades has been probably one of the greatest experiences that I had professionally in my career. I enjoy it every day. From the first day I started coaching till today, it's been nothing but fun. And, you know, I enjoy developing teams, developing players, and just getting to know families and stuff like that. So, yeah, at that part back in 1995, I had no idea that I'd be sitting here talking to you right now.
To that point, 1995, you come back, you've got a program. You're what, 25?
Yeah.
26?
24, 25.
Yeah. Where do you start? Are you overwhelmed? Does it make sense? What are you inheriting? Kind of give me the lay of the land, 1995 at Gwinnett.
I'm inheriting a team that had very little success in a new league called the Pennsylvania Athletic Conference. And really we're treated not as a collegiate program. So the first thing we did, I'll never forget it. Our first meeting we had, I think we had about 25 women attend. And then when we went through what the schedule would look like, you know, one day off because of the NCAA rule. And when I told them we were practicing 6 days a week, the next meeting, it got down to 12. So we had a bunch of women on that first team that played hard all the time and set the standard for how we would play in subsequent years. And then getting back to what we talked about earlier, the one thing I knew I had to do is recruit. We had to bring in good players. And that first recruiting class, we brought in a young lady who played at Hallahan named Michelle Costa, and she turned out to be our school's first Kodak All-American, scored 2,000 points and almost 1,000 rebounds. So that first year, the only thing that felt overwhelming was just trying to create that culture of competitiveness and that you have to be committed. This isn't, you know, a 4-day-a-week club sport. It's a collegiate sport. And, you know, I think we changed that culture over the course of that those first 2 years. Our first game at Gwinnett, I still have it on VHS somewhere. There was one person sitting in the stands, literally one person. To this day, I don't even know who it was sitting in the stands. And, you know, 2 years later, we're hosting the conference semifinals and finals in front of like 1,000 people in our gym. So it was a pretty unique experience from the very beginning till like 2-3 years later, how far we grew.
Did you feel like you were good at it right away?
No, I didn't. I remember coming back when teams went zone against us. It was like kryptonite. You know, I felt like, oh my God, we got to score at least once or twice immediately to get out of the zone. So real early on in my career, after my second year, when I struggled against zone, all I did was study zone offenses and what teams did against it. And nowadays when teams don't play a zone, you know, I'm like, hey, we're wasting all the stuff that we can run against it right now. So, no, I mean, you're constantly evolving as a coach. And, you know, you kind of study. I learned early to study programs along the way, not necessarily try and mirror what they do, but try and just see how they do it, how they teach it, and, you know, and kind of take bits and pieces from other people's programs and kind of make it your own. And that's what I did early on, you know. If we had the internet back then, I think I would have been in front of my computer 24/7 because I watched more game film, called more coaches, and talked to more coaches than I think I ever did in that first 10 years, 12 years as a head coach.
Was there any part, now you'd been a college athlete, you'd been an assistant, but I think it's different when you get your first program. Were there things that all of a sudden were on your plate that you had no idea you were going to have to deal with? Because I think a lot of young coaches just get in and think, oh, I'm just going to coach and this will be great. And, you know, there are just things that all of a sudden are connected to you that are not in the brochure. And it's just how it works. Were there things like that early on for you?
You know, yeah. I mean, the balance of your professional and social life, you know, there. My friend, I was 25 years old. My friends were still going out to Delaware Ave to clubs. And I'm going to, you know, St. Hubert's to go recruit. And that was not that it was a big challenge or it was a big deal. Like my friends were like, just come on out. And I'm like, I can't. Like I got to go out recruiting or, hey, we're going to go to the shore for a week in the summer. And I'm like, well, that's the live period. And I have to be at Penn State for a week because there's a big tournament up there. From an internal standpoint, trying to balance the students' class schedules. It's not Division I where you say, don't take class between 3 and 6 or 12 and 3. That's when we're practicing. You know, at Division III, and I'm sure a lot at Division II, you know, we work around the students' class schedules. So some days you can practice at 3, but then some days you're practicing at 7 o'clock at night because volleyball's in the gym 5 to 7. Or John Barron's in the gym, it seems like from 1 to 10 every day. So those are some of the things that you had to balance that you might miss a student who couldn't come to practice because she has clinical. And those are the things that we constantly monitor and pivot with, you know, even to this day.
Do you remember the first time you talked about how zone kind of threw you for a loop early in your career? Do you remember the first time where you felt like you ran something that was really good or something you worked on came to fruition in a game and just had that feeling of, yes, that's how it's supposed to feel. That's how it's supposed to happen. Or just a game that you just had a game plan that just really worked out well. Do you remember the first time you kind of reached the top of the coaching mountain like that in a moment?
No, I'm still waiting for that to happen. and I'm serious because I, you know, studying programs, I remember listening to Tom Izzo from Michigan State speak one time And he always said, do not be enamored by your coaching ability based upon the talent that you have on your team. So if you have the best players, you're going to be a pretty good coach. So when I was able to bring in those students early in my career, and we won a lot of games, went to the NCAA tournament, it was because of they worked hard in scheme, but because they were the best players. Like, we had the better players on the floor. Like Gino Auriemma used to say, I have Diana Taurasi and you don't. That's why I win. So I think there are moments in games that you're working with your student athletes with something and you see it happen on the floor. That happens all the time. I don't think there was any aha moment. It could be a play off the tap that worked. It could be, out of a timeout, you're in zone, you come back man to man and you run and jump something and you take the other team out of what they call the timeout for. Like, those are the little battles that you play with yourself throughout the game as you manage the game, you manage the clock, you manage the score. So I don't think there was an aha moment.
So we talked earlier about the AD opportunity coming, a few years into your time at Gwinnett. Was that something you embraced right away, or was that something you were like, let me think about it, and I don't know if I, that's a lot. And did you appreciate how much it was when it first came in front of you?
Well, we had a very good president at the time, Sister Linda Bevilacqua, who I interviewed with, and we had a vice president named Sister Katie McMahon, who believed in me. I had a vision for the athletic department. We added baseball, softball. We added track and field. We added men's lacrosse. We added, what am I missing here? If I said women's soccer. So I knew we had an ability to grow as a university. So I embraced it right away. I mean, I legitimately was the athletic director first and still am today, and the basketball coach second, because of the responsibility of, managing 19 sports. But getting to those 19 sports was fun, Matt. I mean, it was, hiring coaches and putting together plans to build and to recruit to the university. I felt that, I embraced that from the very beginning. That's why I wanted the job, because I knew the potential that we had within our athletic department to help the university grow enrollment-wise. So no, from the very beginning, there was no hesitation. I wanted the job from the very beginning. And I said, I had good mentors. I had Tom Shirley at Philly U, or Thomas Jefferson now, helped me out. John Zeke, who was at Cabrini at the time, helped me out tremendously. Shirley Little, who was the AD at Arcadia at the time. I had professional mentors that I could pick up the phone and could have a master's level class, or in my case, a 100 level class on how to do certain things. Tom Shirley brought me to his office and said, come down. I'm going to show you what I do on this particular subject. It was budget. And, I still do my budget how Tom taught me 25 years ago.
You talked about having the best, when you're coaching and you've got the best kids on the floor, but there's an art to coaching talent too. Like, I think there's, and I don't know if pressure is the right word, but you've got kids that are better than, maybe 8 of the 9 teams in the conference. But that doesn't mean you're going to go 16-2 in the conference. Isn't there something to be said for the ability to not just bring the talent in, but utilize it to its fullest potential that you should kind of pat yourself on the back a little bit for?
Well, I've never in my 27 years made a jump shot or layup. It's all the players that I'm doing it. So I give them all the credit. I don't know. That's a good question. I never pat myself on the back, because we just had a tough loss the other day. And the first thing I did was sit down and figure out what I did wrong, and then watch film and not be really accusatory of what are doing, but just say, hey guys, this is how we can do it differently. How we do it better. But when you do coach talent, you really have to give them the space to fail, because by giving them space to fail, it helps them become better players. I still do that today. Even, if my roster top to bottom might not be as talented as some of my teams we had back in the 2000s, early 2000s, you still have to give them space to learn how to do things. And then watching film and looking at stats, and then just talking through things. You know, that's how I've evolved as a coach, is finding ways to motivate and to teach differently to different generation of students. What I did back in 1997, 1998 is totally different than what I did in 09 and 08, and which I do totally different in 19 and now in 22. Totally different. So I think it's just like evolving as an AD. You continually evolve as a coach and you just find different ways to motivate your student athletes.
You've had a ton of success. If I counted correctly, I think it's 7 conference championships, 9 NCAA tournaments. You had a couple of years, I think 06, 07, where you ran the table in conference back-to-back years. I think the overall record was 51-7. What is it like to be at that level where, you know, within the context of your conference, you are UConn, you are South Carolina, you are the team that everybody, when the schedule comes out, they circle. When does Gwynn and Mercy come to town? And that's a challenge in itself, getting a group of kids prepared that you're every night you play, it is the biggest game for the other team. And that can be a grind on your team. How did you handle being at that level for that long?
And I will throw in, it was 06, 07, even in 08, we lost at the buzzer in the finals. We didn't lose a game in our conference for basically 3 seasons. And I don't think we lost a game under 10 points. I mean, like we won a game under 10 points. So it was that special group of students that came through from freshmen to seniors that failed as freshmen, but then sophomore, junior, and senior year succeeded. Matt, honestly, it was easy because they were so talented. They were so competitive and committed to getting better. They stayed in shape. You know, they were good academically. You know, I really tried to get out of their way. You know, we put together game plans, but in timeouts, you know, they had the autonomy at that time to say, "Coach, I think we should switch to this because this is what I'm seeing out there." And I'm like, okay. And I'll tell you right now, that probably worked. I took their suggestions. 9 out of 10 times, it was the right call. So I, as a coach, you know, yes, I get the credit for winning, but it was that era was our players. They were so, as I'm sitting here in my office, there are 3 pictures of those teams in my office, and they were just so focused and they knew how to win. And that we, as a coaching staff, do we help them along? Probably, but I just think they were tough Philly kids that were the nucleus of that team that wind up, you know, having that success. So, you know, the Philly roots come in a little bit, Philly Catholic school kids. It was the players during that era, really, you know, more than me.
Do conference championships, do tournament appearances, do they hit different from a satisfaction standpoint, depending upon the road traveled to get there and maybe how much the group improved from day one to day, you know, 150 or whatever? Is there, I mean, they're all satisfying. I don't want to, you know, you never take any for granted, but do they feel different depending upon kind of the circumstances of an individual year?
Yeah, because I mean, I don't know how many coaches go into a season expecting to win a championship. I think they go in with the expectation to build towards that, but you know, not to be cliche-ish, but it's all about the journey. It's not about the end goal. And, you know, we did have a team that won. I think we started the season like 2-9 or 2-10. And then we wind up going on like a 11 game winning streak and, you know, winning the conference championship and getting the automatic bid. Like that team was unique in a way where it started out so slow and then it just clicked. Whereas, you know, those 06, 07, 08 teams were so good that it was almost an expectation that we'd get to the championship. But as you know, anything can happen in a given day. I mean, I think I lost more championships than I've won them, you know, in the conference that we're in. So no, I don't treat them any differently because they're always a surprise. Like, at least in my eyes, like when you win a championship, it's so unexpected, unless you're Geno and you have all the players, or you're Dawn Staley, you have all the players, and you're expected to win. I don't think that's ever the case at Division III, because there's so many factors that go into it that, you know, when you do win a championship, you kind of just, you know, you're just happy at that moment in time. When I look back at it, I don't feel any differently, really, on any of the championships or NCAA tournament appearances that we had.
How have you changed since?
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Why does every recipe I try need 18 ingredients, including a jar of something paste I'll never use again but will sit in my fridge for 9 months? I just want dinner in the oven, fast. That's why I love Blue Apron's new one-pan assemble and bake meals. They send you fresh ingredients that are already chopped. All you do is put it all together and bake. That's it. No chopping, no weird leftovers, just delicious, easy-to-make meals. Get 20% off your first two orders with code APRON20. Terms and conditions apply. Visit blueapron.com/terms for more.
You know how in football, timing is everything? You miss your window by a second, and the play's already gone. The holidays are the same way. Everything happens fast, and if you're not ready, you're scrambling at the last minute. That's why Amazon Prime is the real MVP this season.
With Prime's fast, free shipping, you can make those last-minute calls look effortless. Forgot your secret Santa gift? Need something for that office party? Prime's got your back, helping you go from uh-oh to all set faster than a two-minute drill.
Absolutely, Mark, because Prime isn't just about getting things fast. It's about making sure you never miss your shot. It turns that last-minute scramble into a smooth holiday win. So this season, remember, Prime's fast delivery has your back during the holidays, especially when it's down to the wire and can't wait another minute. Last-minute gifts delivered. It's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to shop now.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Avoiding your unfinished home projects because you're not sure where to start? Thumbtack knows homes, so you don't have to. Don't know the difference between matte paint finish and satin? Or what that clunking sound from your dryer is? With Thumbtack, you don't have to be a home pro. You just have to hire one. You can hire top-rated pros, see price estimates, and read reviews, all on the app. Download today.
And we are back. Our guest this week is Gwinnett Mercy University head women's basketball coach and athletic director, Keith Mondillo. So you get the start at Gwinnett, and then after a season, you go back to your alma mater, Arcadia, for a year. And I'm curious, for that year in Arcadia, I would imagine there are still kids you played with that were on the team. And how difficult was that? I mean, there's a year break and you're not around. So there is kind of that separation where it's not one day your teammates and the next day you're in a position of authority. But did it lead to any awkwardness where, you know, maybe you're in a different role and it just leads to a different dynamic with people you played with?
No, not really, because I mean, I was still young. It was my second year. And yeah, I did play with a bunch of those guys. And I was more of the go-between between our head coach, not that he couldn't do it, but and the players. And our head coach, Mike Holland, gave me a lot of autonomy to do some things. And I would give him suggestions because we were so athletic. I remember that team like it was yesterday, about pressing things and what we can do and how we can trap and rotate. So I think when the players saw that Mike Holland was giving me that latitude, that I wouldn't say it changed over right away, but I think they saw me more as now a coach as opposed to their former teammate. I think we're always going to be former teammates, but what Mike Holland did enabled me to develop as a coach, not only personally, but in the eyes of the players at that time. So it wasn't as awkward or difficult as you would think it would be.
So one season back at your alma mater, and then the women's position at Gwynedd Mercy becomes yours. Kind of what's the road back to Gwynedd and to this, to running your own program?
Well, the gentleman who I coached with, he was an assistant at Arcadia that year, wind up becoming the athletic director at Gwynedd. And at the time, I'm thinking I'm going to be the next Mike Krzyzewski. I know we all laugh about it, but we all, like, every coach, young coach, aspires to the highest level. Well, he asked me to coach the women's team at Gwynedd, and I balked for about 2 months. And finally, he said, I'll get it to you. It'll be full-time next year. You know, just try it. If you don't like it, you can leave. Well, I had, at that point, I had not coached any sports that involved women. And 27 years later, I definitely made the best decision ever, because I thoroughly enjoy it. Not that I would never go back and coach men. I coach my son's AAU team, but coaching the women at Gwynedd for the basically almost three decades has been probably one of the greatest experiences that I had professionally in my career. I enjoy it every day. From the first day I started coaching till today, it's been nothing but fun. And, you know, I enjoy developing teams, developing players, and just getting to know families and stuff like that. So, you know, at that part back in 1995, I had no idea that I'd be sitting here talking to you right now.
To that point, 1995, you come back, you've got a program. You're what, 25?
Yeah.
26?
24, 25.
Yeah. Where do you start? Are you overwhelmed? Does it make sense? What are you inheriting? Kind of give me the lay of the land, 1995 at Gwynedd.
I'm inheriting a team that had very little success in a new league called the Pennsylvania Athletic Conference. And really, we're treated not as a collegiate program. So the first thing we did, I'll never forget it. Our first meeting we had, I think we had about 25 women attend. And then when we went through what the schedule would look like, you know, one day off because of the NCAA rule. And when I told them we were practicing 6 days a week, the next meeting, it got down to 12. So we had a bunch of women on that first team that played hard all the time and set the standard for how we would play in subsequent years. And then getting back to what we talked about earlier, the one thing I knew I had to do is recruit. We had to bring in good players. And that first recruiting class, we brought in a young lady who played at Hallahan named Michelle Costa. She turned out to be our school's first Kodak All-American, scored 2,000 points and almost 1,000 rebounds. So that first year, the only thing that felt overwhelming was just trying to create that culture of competitiveness and that you have to be committed. This isn't, you know, a four-day-a-week club sport. It's a collegiate sport. And, you know, I think we changed that culture over the course of those first 2 years. Our first game at Gwynedd, I still have it on VHS somewhere. There was one person sitting in the stands, literally one person. To this day, I don't even know who it was sitting in the stands. And, you know, 2 years later, we're hosting the conference semifinals and finals in front of like 1,000 people in our gym. So it was a pretty unique experience from the very beginning till like 2-3 years later, how far we grew.
Did you feel like you were good at it right away?
No, I didn't. I remember coming back when teams went zone against us. It was like kryptonite. You know, I felt like, oh my God, we got to score at least once or twice immediately to get out of the zone. So real early on in my career, after my second year, when I struggled against zone, all I did was study zone offenses and what teams did against it. And nowadays, when teams don't play a zone, you know, I'm like, hey, we're wasting all the stuff that we can run against it right now. So, no, I mean, you're constantly evolving as a coach. And, you know, you kind of study. I learned early to study programs along the way, not necessarily try and mirror what they do, but try and just see how they do it, how they teach it, and, you know, and kind of take bits and pieces from other people's programs and kind of make it your own. And that's what I did early on. You know, if we had the internet back then, I think I would have been in front of my computer 24/7 because I watched more game film, called more coaches, and talked to more coaches than I think I ever did in that first 10 years, 12 years as a head coach.
Was there any part, now you'd been a college athlete, you'd been an assistant, but I think it's different when you get your first program. Were there things that all of a sudden were on your plate that you had no idea you were going to have to deal with? Because I think a lot of young coaches just get in and think, oh, I'm just going to coach and this will be great. And, you know, there are just things that all of a sudden are connected to you that are not in the brochure. And it's just how it works. Were there things like that early on for you?
You know, yeah. I mean, the balance of your professional and social life, you know, there. My friend, I was 25 years old. My friends were still going out to Delaware Ave to clubs. And I'm going to, you know, St. Hubert's to go recruit. And that was not that it was a big challenge or it was a big deal. Like my friends were like, just come on out. And I'm like, I can't. Like I got to go out recruiting or, hey, we're going to go to the shore for a week in the summer. And I'm like, well, that's the live period. And I have to be at Penn State for a week because there's a big tournament up there. From an internal standpoint, trying to balance the students' class schedules. It's not Division I where you say, don't take class between 3 and 6 or 12 and 3. That's when we're practicing. You know, at Division III, and I'm sure a lot at Division II, you know, we work around the students' class schedules. So some days you can practice at 3, but then some days you're practicing at 7 o'clock at night because volleyball's in the gym 5 to 7. Or John Barron's in the gym, seems like from 1 to 10 every day. So those are some of the things that you had to balance that you might miss a student who couldn't come to practice because she has clinical. And those are the things that we just have to constantly monitor and pivot with, you know, even to this day.
Do you remember the first time you talked about how zone kind of threw you for a loop early in your career? Do you remember the first time where you felt like you ran something that was really good or something you worked on came to fruition in a game and just had that feeling of, yes, that's how it's supposed to feel. That's how it's supposed to happen. Or just a game that you just had a game plan that just really worked out well. Do you remember the first time you kind of reached the top of the coaching mountain like that in a moment?
No, I'm still waiting for that to happen. and I'm serious because I, you know, studying programs, I remember listening to Tom Izzo from Michigan State speak one time, and he always said, do not be enamored by your coaching ability based upon the talent that you have on your team. So if you have the best players, you're going to be a pretty good coach. So when I was able to bring in those students early in my career and we won a lot of games, went to the NCAA tournament, it was because of they worked hard in scheme, but because they were the best players. Like we had the better players on the floor. Like Gino Auriemma used to say, I have Diana Taurasi and you don't. That's why I win. I think there are moments in games that you're working with your student athletes with something and you see it happen on the floor. That happens all the time. I don't think there was any aha moment. It could be, you know, a play off the tap that worked. It could be, you know, out of a timeout, you know, you're in zone, you come back man to man and you run and jump something and you take the other team out of what they call the timeout for. Like those are the little battles that you play with yourself throughout the game as you manage the game, you manage the clock, you manage the score. So I don't think there was an aha moment.
So we talked earlier about the AD opportunity coming, you know, a few years into your time at Gwinnett. Was that something you embraced right away? Or was that something you were like, let me think about it. And I don't know if I, you know, that's a lot. And did you appreciate how much it was when it first came in front of you?
Well, we had a very good president at the time, Sister Linda Bevilacqua, who I interviewed with, and we had a vice president named Sister Katie McMahon who believed in me. I had a vision for the athletic department. We added baseball, softball. We added track and field. We added men's Lacrosse, we added, what am I missing here? If I said women's soccer. So I knew we had an ability to grow as a university. So I embraced it right away. I mean, I legitimately was the athletic director first and still am today, and the basketball coach second, because of the responsibility of, you know, managing 19 sports. But getting to those 19 sports was fun, Matt. I mean, it was, you know, hiring coaches and putting together plans to build and to recruit to the university. I felt that, you know, I embraced that from the very beginning. That's why I wanted the job, because I knew the potential that we had within our athletic department to help the university grow enrollment-wise. So no, from the very beginning, there was no hesitation. I wanted the job from the very beginning. And I said, I had good mentors. I had Tom Shirley at Philly U, or Thomas Jefferson now, helped me out. John Zeke, who was at Cabrini at the time, helped me out tremendously. Shirley Little, who was the AD at Arcadia at the time. You know, I had professional mentors that I could pick up the phone and could have a master's level class, or in my case, you know, a 100 level class on how to do certain things. Tom Shirley brought me to his office and said, you know, come down, I'm going to show you what I do on this particular subject. It was budget. And, you know, I still do my budget how Tom taught me 25 years ago.
You talked about having the best, you know, when you're coaching and you've got the best kids on the floor, but there's an art to coaching talent too. Like, I think there's, and I don't know if pressure is the right word, but you know, you've got kids that are better than, you know, maybe 8 of the 9 teams in the conference. But that doesn't mean you're going to go 16-2 in the conference. Isn't there something to be said for the ability to not just bring the talent in, but utilize it to its fullest potential, that you should kind of pat yourself on the back a little bit for?
Well, I've never in my 27 years made a jump shot or layup. It's all the players that I'm doing it. So I give them all the credit. I don't know. That's a good question. I never pat myself on the back, because we just had a tough loss the other day, and the first thing I did was sit down and figure out what I did wrong, and then watch film and not be really accusatory of what are doing, but just say, hey guys, this is how we can do it differently, how we do it better. But when you do coach talent, you really have to give them the you know, the space to fail, because by giving them space to fail, it helps them become better players. I still do that today. Even, you know, if my roster top to bottom might not be as talented as some of my teams we had back in the 2000s, early 2000s, you still have to give them space to learn how to do things. And then watching film and looking at stats, you know, and then just talking through things, you know, that's how I've evolved as a coach, is finding ways to motivate and to teach differently to different generation of students. What I did back in 1997, 1998 is totally different than what I did in 09 and 08, and which I do totally different in 19 and now in 22. Totally different. So I think it's just like evolving as an AD. You continually evolve as a coach and just find different ways to motivate your student athletes.
You've had a ton of success. If I counted correctly, I think it's 7 conference championships, 9 NCAA tournaments. You had a couple of years, I think 06, 07, where you ran the table in conference back-to-back years. I think the overall record was 51-7. What is it like to be at that level where, you know, within the context of your conference, you are UConn, you are South Carolina, you are the team that everybody, when the schedule comes out, they circle. When does Gwynn and Mercy come to town? And that's a challenge in itself, getting a group of kids prepared that you're, every night you play, it is the biggest game for the other team. And that can be a grind on your team. How did you handle being at that level for that long?
And I will throw in, it was 06, 07, even in 08, we lost at the buzzer in the finals. We didn't lose a game in our conference for basically 3 seasons. And I don't think we lost a game under 10 points. I mean, like, we won a game under 10 points. So it was that special group of students that came through from freshmen to seniors that failed as freshmen, but then sophomore, junior, and senior year succeeded. Matt, honestly, it was easy because they were so talented. They were so competitive and committed to getting better. They stayed in shape. You know, they were good academically. You know, I really tried to get out of their way. You know, we put together game plans, but in timeouts, you know, they had the autonomy at that time to say, "Coach, I think we should switch to this because this is what I'm seeing out there." And I'm like, "Okay." And I'll tell you right now, if that probably worked, I took their suggestions. 9 out of 10 times, it was the right call. So I, as a coach, you know, yes, I get the credit for winning, but it was that era was our players. They were so, as I'm sitting here in my office, there are 3 pictures of those teams in my office, and they were just so focused and they knew how to win. And that we, as a coaching staff, do we help them along? Probably, but I just think they were tough Philly kids that were the nucleus of that team that wind up, you know, having that success. So, you know, the Philly roots come in a little bit, Philly Catholic school kids. It was the players during that era, really, you know, more than me.
Do conference championships, do tournament appearances, do they hit different from a satisfaction standpoint, depending upon the road traveled to get there and maybe how much the group improved from day one to day, you know, 150 or whatever? Is there, I mean, they're all satisfying. I don't want to, you know, you never take any for granted, but do they feel different depending upon kind of the circumstances of an individual year?
Yeah, because I mean, I don't know how many coaches go into a season expecting to win a championship. I think they go in with the expectation to build towards that. But, you know, not to be cliche-ish, but it's all about the journey. It's not about the end goal. And, you know, we did have a team that won. I think we started the season like 2-9 or 2-10. And then we wind up going on like a 10-game winning streak, 11-game winning streak, and, you know, winning the conference championship and getting the automatic bid. Like, that team was unique in a way where it started out so slow and then it just clicked. Whereas, you know, those 06, 07, 08 teams were so good that it was almost an expectation that we'd get to the championship. But as you know, anything could happen in a given day. I mean, I think I lost more championships than I've won them, you know, in the conference that we're in. So I don't treat them any differently because they're always a surprise. Like, at least in my eyes, like when you win a championship, it's so unexpected. Unless you're Geno and you have all the players, or you're Dawn Staley, you have all the players and you're expected to win. I don't think that's ever the case at Division III because there's so many factors that go into it that, you know, when you do win a championship, you kind of just, you know, you're just happy at that moment in time. When I look back at it, I don't feel any differently really on any of the championships or NCAA tournament appearances that we had.
How have you changed since 1995 in how you approach either a game or a roster or X's and O's? You know, how do you feel you've changed over the last 25, 26, 27 years?
Well, I have 2 children of my own. And, you know, at this point, probably 15 years ago, you know, you figured out different ways to motivate. You know, you watch, when I grew up, who did you see all the time on the sidelines? Like Bobby Knight yelling and screaming. And at some point, you have to figure out a different way to motivate. I think we motivate today, have I developed, in different ways. You know, it's a shared goal, it's shared expectations, as opposed to me, you know, imposing, well, this is what we're going to do. You know, there's an old saying, if no one leads, your team's always going to be bad. If a coach leads, the team's going to be okay. But if the players lead, you're always going to have a good program, a good season. And I always strive for the third, having the players lead. So that's where that shared ownership of, you know, they're not sitting here writing a practice plan with me, but in meetings and in discussions with individuals and as a whole, you kind of develop a shared ownership of how your season's going to go. And I think that's how I changed more. Like in the beginning, it was like, this is what we're going to do and how we're going to do it. And now, you know, the athletes today are different. I see it in my own son and daughter who play high school sports that, you know, you can't be the Bobby Knight from 1976. You have to be the Keith Mondillo from, you know, modern day times.
I'm curious because you got the job so young, Ed Gwynedd. And I think, you know, I remember my own career steps, 23, 24, 25. You're not necessarily thinking this is where I'm going to put my flag in the ground. A lot of it's just kind of year to year or, you know, well, I'll be here a couple of years. And then was it a conscious thing that I'm so happy I can have success here that this is where I want to be? Or was it kind of, you know, the AD opportunity comes and you've done that for a few years and all of a sudden you're there for 10 years and you're happy, you're enjoying it, you're building a family and it goes by like that? Or was there a moment when you said, this is where I want to be?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know if it was ever a conscious moment saying, this is where I want to be, because I'm not content with the job as AD or coach. Because I always think I could be better, or we can get better. But at some point, I knew I wanted to be close to Philadelphia when it came to basketball. The traditions, the teams, the community, and how close it is. Whether I'm a Division III women's coach or you're a Division I men's coach in the city, there's always that mutual respect for each other. No one looks down at anybody. So I've been lucky enough that our leadership at Gwinnett Mercy over the years has been strong. To our current president right now, Deanne D'Amelio, who is, you know, has a total different vision for the university. So when she came on board four years ago, it just reinstilled the values of what Gwinnett's about, who we are and where we're going to go. and, you know, the vice presidential leadership over the years has been strong. So I think all that combined with wanting to keep my family rooted at one place and liking what I do here. I never actually said, this is where I'm going to be. It just so happens this is where I'm at. And I've had a ball. I'm 50 years old. I turned 50 last summer. I have a lot of years left in me. And as long as the university wants me, I'll be here.
And you kind of went into this, my next question, with your last answer, but the Philadelphia basketball community is unique. You have dropped names throughout this. And I don't mean that in an E, but just part of the fabric of everyday life when you coach hoops in the city. You know, how much does that mean to you? It's pretty obvious from what you've already said, but I'd like you to go a little further. Just being part of this tapestry that is unique, I think, in the world, that there's not another area that kind of has something like the basketball community in Philadelphia.
Yeah, like I said earlier, and I don't want to name drop, but I did grow up down the street from the Mars family, Speedy Mars, and he opened up a lot of doors. Getting to know from my college coach, even before I met him when I was in college, Jay Wright. When Jay Wright was an assistant coach at Drexel, the same guy you see on TV today was the same guy at Drexel 20-some years ago. And but then talking to like guys like Tom Shirley, you know, who I've won more games than I've ever appeared in as a player or coach, or John Zeke at Cabrini at the time. And then like even John Barron. John Barron's one of the most successful Division III coaches, you know, in the last 50 years in this area. Being able to talk to those guys, and not necessarily like I was never into rubbing elbows just because you're a Division I coach. I'd rather sit down and talk with, you know, coaches at any level about what they do in their craft. And that's the unique part of Philadelphia basketball. Like, you know, I'm not telling anything you don't know, but it's that camaraderie that, you know, I'll get a text after a win from a coach who I don't even think he or she followed what we were doing. You know, hey, great win last night. That the Philly basketball is, you know, it's the biggest small city in the world, Philadelphia. Everybody knows everybody. I mean, I remember growing up playing basketball in Roxburgh, but traveling up to Northeast Philly to play at a playground somewhere or down in Port Richmond, and knowing the guys from North, knowing the guys from LaSalle, from Judge, you know, Mike McLaughlin at Penn, you know, he was at Holy Family for years. Mike's and I've been friends for forever. And again, it's not about dropping names. It's about friendships. And I don't know any other profession that it's that close for that long period of time at so many levels. I mean, maybe you might know it in your industry, but I've never experienced it at all in mine.
And my final question for you, absolute favorite part of what you do?
Every day is different. There isn't one, like I don't go to an assembly line and I have to do A, B, and C before 11 o'clock. Every day is different. And dealing with the student athletes, just not on my team, but all the other teams, and seeing them develop and help them along their 4 years in college, that's what keeps it going.
Keith Mondillo, thanks so much for the time. This was great.
Matt, I appreciate it. Thank you.
And that will do it for this week's episode. Want to thank Gwinnett Mercy University Athletic Director and Head Women's Basketball Coach Keith Mondillo for being my guest this week. If you like this show and you listen on Apple Podcasts and want to help us out, leave us a rating and a review. You can follow the show on Twitter at @1on1pod. You can follow me on Twitter as well at @MattLeon1060. Thanks so much for listening, and be sure to join us again next time when we bring you another conversation with someone you should know more about.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up, you get early payout on parlays too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
You know how in football, timing is everything? You miss your window by a second and the play's already gone. The holidays are the same way. Everything happens fast, and if you're not ready, you're scrambling at the last minute. That's why Amazon Prime is the real MVP this season.
With Prime's fast, free shipping, you can make those last-minute calls look effortless. Forgot your secret Santa gift? Need something for that office party? Prime's got your back, helping you go from uh-oh to all set faster than a two-minute drill.
Absolutely, Mark, because Prime isn't just about getting things fast. It's about making sure you never miss your shot. It turns that last-minute scramble into a smooth holiday win. So this season, remember, Prime's fast delivery has your back during the holidays, especially when it's down to the wire and can't wait another minute. Last-minute gifts delivered, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to shop now.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
So you want to start a business. You might think you need a team of people and fancy tech skills, but you don't. You just need GoDaddy Airo. I'm Walton Goggins, and as an actor, I'm an expert in looking like I know what I'm doing. GoDaddy Airo uses AI to create everything you need to grow a business. It'll make you a unique logo. It'll create a custom website. It'll write social posts for you and even set you up with a social media calendar. Get started at GoDaddy.com/Airo. That's GoDaddy.com/AIRO.
I'm caught up in the game. My attention is on every play and every whistle. But what I'm missing is a signal coming from my kidneys. That signal isn't like a ref's whistle. It's more of a silent SOS, which could be warning me of an increased risk for events like heart attack or stroke. And a way I can catch that signal? A simple urine test called UACR. If you have type 2 diabetes or high blood pressure, talk to your doctor about the UACR test. Detect the SOS. Visit DetectTheSOS.com to learn more.